Yes, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Bryant. Man, my voice sounds gravelly. That's what you get for singing Taking Care of Christmas last night. Look what this has done for me. Yes, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Jeff. This is Now We're Talking. I'm here with Victor Noriega. Victor, we've talked about you coming in for quite some time, and I kept postponing it. There are all these different reasons, but I knew it was going to happen before the end of the year. This is the last show of the year.
Oh, wow.
So I'm glad we made it in 2017.
I did a lot of postponing also.
It was equal. It was equal. Yes. But I never was concerned it wasn't going to happen. I knew we were just finding the sweet spot, and it's December 10th, 2017.
Yes.
Not to date ourselves to somebody listening to this in the future, but this is, you are listening to the past right now if you're listening in podcast form. But I'm glad you're here, man. We gigged the last two nights together.
We have.
So it's been the weekend of Jeff and Victor.
I know. It's been an epic weekend.
Yeah.
Lots of funny moments.
Yes. And you can hear probably the, I sound so sexy right now. I'm not, and I don't say that about myself lightly, but I'm just listening to this. I've really settled into a nice radio gravel. Maybe this is the thing. I should gig Friday, Saturday night, do the show on Sunday, and give the people that the impression that I'm way more sexy than I am.
Yes. Yeah. The breathy, gravelly.
Wow.
Kind of, delivery.
You can hear it, right?
I like it.
Yeah. You should see Victor. He's smiling from ear to ear.
I'm always smiling from ear to ear. That's true.
You are.
I love everything.
You are quite a content individual. I'll give you that.
Thank you.
Yes, I appreciate your energy on the gigs, which is how we know each other. We play music together for, I don't know, maybe 3-ish years?
Yeah.
We play in a band called Side One. When did you start playing with Side One?
Oh, boy. I think it would be like 2012.
Maybe that's when we met them.
2013.
Yeah.
I was out of town. I moved to New York for a short period of time, and then I came back in 2013, but I was already kind of had a foot into doing those gigs before then. So
you've done the cover music thing before with other cover bands in Vancouver before.
I did.
As well.
I really started doing that really for the first time in 2009 when I came to Vancouver.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had not done gigs like that before, and I had played a lot of music before in Seattle, but like I never got called for that kind of gig.
Yeah.
And I went through a boot camp.
Oh, really?
For sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's totally
the rival
different.
Band of the band. The
unnamed rival band. That's how seriously we take cover music in Vancouver.
No,
I'm resisting the urge to name it.
I know. It's all the same songs. Okay. Everything's the same.
I mean, I guess if anybody's wondering, I mean, right away, you know, you're a composer, you're an accomplished piano player. We're talking about cover music. I mean, that really represents the fact that when you make a living as a musician, you do it in any number of ways.
Yeah. I mean, like, everybody has to work, you know?
Yes.
And, like, I've got a skill set. This is what I went to school for, not necessarily cover music, but, music and, like, being able to identify harmonies and melodies and being able to, play the piano.
Yeah.
Like that's all in my wheelhouse. And,
although that being said, last night when you were playing Taking Care of Christmas, which is a satirical take on the classic rock song Taking Care of Business, were you thinking to yourself, actually, this is not what I went to school for?
Did you have that notion? No, well, part of, and I kind of learned this at school, too. I mean, well, I went to the University of Washington, and there were two, music schools in Seattle. There was the UW. We call it the UW down there.
The UW. I'm willing to call it that. It makes sense to me.
It does make sense.
To my Canadian ears, it makes sense.
There's UW, which is, the big university, and then there was Cornish, which is, Cornish College for the Arts. Mm-hmm. And there are some other smaller ones, but those are, kind of the main ones. And Cornish had, an artistic view, approach to things, and other things were important to them. Not that being professional and learning how to play a gig was not, important to Cornish, but that was more kind of stressed from the school I went in, that approach, and just being a professional,
Yeah.
And I don't want to, I don't want to overstep my, my boundaries of, I don't want to categorize Cornish as a non-professional endeavor or whatever.
Different approaches, right?
Different
I understand
approaches,
that from acting as well. There's the more, with a university approach, for example, to acting, let's say, I think it applies to music too. It's a little bit more academic, and then there's the practical approach at certain colleges. Mm-hmm. You went to UW instead of this other school that you're mentioning.
Right.
And what was it you gained from the experience you had at UW?
I just called it UW casually.
I'm taking it on.
The UW was, again, this was kind of the main music school in Seattle. Again, there's two, but the UW was revered as the professional school,
Yeah.
You go in and then you're a solid musician. And then Cornish was, again, kind of an artistic approach, be creative, be yourself, et cetera.
Yeah. Know. Yeah.
What was the question again?
Well, there's all sorts of things we're going to talk about. I'm just thinking, as I'm hearing some of these details from your history, how for you as my friend, one of the good things about the show, when I do have a friend come in and I'm interested to go through this process, is to kind of connect the dots, because I know certain things about your resume and your history as a musician. I'm thinking about an experience you had composing something that was in Oakland?
Yep.
There's all sorts of things we're going to get into here, but maybe we should go through it chronologically and kind of shed some light on the process. I guess one of the things I'm curious about is you as a piano player. How did that come about? A lot of people, when they're kids, they might take piano lessons, and very few of them end up making a living out of it, right? Mm, so was your experience initially with the piano like a lot of other kids, where you casually started doing it, or at a young age did you have a stronger sense that it was going to be more important to you? How did it play out?
Well, I was exposed to it a lot. My dad played piano.
He did.
Like, he was an avid pianist just
okay.
at home.
So he was
always a professional
there.
But like, he was always playing, and he loved playing, and
he had a piano.
He had
in the
skill,
house,
yeah? Yeah, definitely. And he oh, had cool. skill. He had like a good ear, and like, he knew jazz tunes, and he okay. could figure out how to play other songs just by ear, right?
Okay.
So he had like kind of these natural skills, and you know, I was fascinated by it when I was a kid. And
do you have memories of listening to him before you even attempted to play?
Yeah,
like just focusing on dad playing. That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. So I attribute a lot of what I do now to being brought up in that environment with my dad, like playing a lot, you
know? Genetically and environmentally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm always intrigued by this. I'm always intrigued to talk to artists and musicians who had the experience within the family of music, because
mm-hmm.
I didn't. You know, I think my family certainly appreciated music,
mm-hmm.
but I never had the experience of instruments really being played around the house. I'm always intrigued by what that would do.
Mm-hmm.
When I think about having kids in the future, I kind of, you know, I don't want to impose it on them, but I wonder what that would be like to just sort of like, as you know, as soon as the pregnancy occurs, to just put some headphones
mm-hmm.
onto. I guess it would be my wife's belly, and to play some Beatles songs or whatever, and just ruin them for life. But
I have a memory from childhood, and I don't remember my dad actually being in a band, but like, I remember he would have like these jam sessions sometimes, and like, guys would come over and they would play, and I remember specifically that they were playing like a 12-bar blues, right?
Okay.
And they didn't tell me that they were playing a 12-bar blues.
But in retrospect, you can identify as that?
But I kind of understood what was going on, though. And
right.
I was kind of...
How old are you?
I don't know, like 7, 8, something like that.
Yeah, you could identify the pattern somehow.
Yeah, I could.
You're like, it's coming around back to this bit now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
yeah.
I remember that. But like, you know, he had the people come over, though. You know, that's like a big thing. That's a big part of it, right?
Yeah.
He set up the opportunity for me to like kind of soak it in.
Be exposed to collaboration too.
Yeah.
Not just him playing, but other people collaborating and making it happen.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And so was your early experience learning through him teaching you, or did you have a teacher?
I had a teacher.
Yeah.
He maybe tried to teach me once or twice, but but he was more of a player than a teacher, really.
Right.
but I did take piano lessons, and I took like traditional piano lessons, and you know, I wanted to stop maybe a couple times throughout, you know, in my childhood, and but for whatever reason, I just stuck with it. And then in high school, I got introduced to jazz as like an actual kind of like, oh, learn jazz piano. You know, and because the jazz band at my school was good, and I wanted to be a part of it, and like also I was interested in jazz peripherally just through my dad, right. But then this, you know, the opportunity came up in high school to like play in the jazz band, and it was a good band, and like there were like revered musicians, you know, senior musicians in the band, and like I worked really hard to like just, you know, be at that level.
Yeah, raise your game, right?
Exactly.
That's always the way to get better, is to have people around you that are doing it at that higher level.
Yeah.
You're going to need to catch up.
And I was focused. And like, I can confidently say I was focused from high school through college, just like trying to like be really great at jazz piano.
Yeah.
You know?
And was it always about jazz because of that influence from your dad?
Yes. Well, actually, when I first started playing music with people, and I was doing like piano lessons throughout all this in high school, but like I joined like a rock band, like a punk band actually.
Okay, cool.
And I played bass.
Okay.
I kind of like barged my way into this band actually.
It was
like
in high school?
These guys, yeah, it was these guys and they were starting a band and then like I just somehow butted my way in.
I became,
you know, in the band and I played bass. I played some drums also and I also sang a bit. But that was all just, well, you know, we wanted to be a good band, but it was part of, you know, the camaraderie and like working with people. And then when I was studying jazz piano, like I wanted that camaraderie and working with people too, but there was just this, you know, high level. I wanted to achieve a lot, you know, because it's hard. It's difficult music to learn.
Right? Yeah, I can only imagine. I mean,
and you asked me if I was, you know, basically if you want to be good at jazz piano, and just good too, not great, just good, like you really have to have the blinders on and have tunnel vision for some period of time, because like that's the only way that you're actually going to like understand like the language. And
you gotta go in the really trenches.
You have to like kind of phase other things out. For some people do it for their entire lives, meaning that they're like focused on jazz, but again, if you want to be competent, then you have to have a period of just blocking the other musics out.
When you say that, I'm curious, when did that period end for you? What was that like? Was it finishing university, or what was the moment where you decided, I'm not going to wear blinders my entire life? It sounds like it's a choice that's made for somebody to develop probably a heroin addiction. I'm thinking about cliches around jazz by just living in there, because maybe that would be at the expense of a family and other experiences that you have in life.
Well, honestly, I mean, you know, I was a jazz pianist, you know, coming out of high school and college, and I had these gigs, and most of my, my identity was playing jazz, you know. And then when I moved to Vancouver and I got into this cover band thing.
Changed your whole life.
It did, though, but really for the better, like, I think, you know, I mean, it was like, it was out of necessity that I had to like kind of, you know, remove these blinders and be like, okay, there's a lot more to music in general than just playing jazz.
Is it fair to say, this is my sense from knowing other musicians, music colleagues that we have in common, many of whom study jazz, is that like the best foundation you could hope to have to then apply to other styles of playing music? Maybe that's a general statement, but
I would say so, because it's high level, you know, it's upper level kind of thinking when you're playing jazz.
Yeah.
Definitely.
That's what I'm thinking.
That said, it's like that can get in the way of like some kind of basic kind of stuff that you need to do also.
Like what?
Well, to just play the part, you know? Like the jazz guys, like maybe they might not embrace that as much as like somebody who plays in a cover band, you know?
Right, so if you're playing a cover band and it's like, here's the part on the record, execute that part.
Yeah, exactly.
That could potentially be boring intellectually.
Yeah, exactly.
Versus actually intellectually engaging in the music and seeing where it takes you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's got to be one of the biggest differences between these two
things. Yeah, it's totally different. But I've really learned to embrace it, and I have a better appreciation of music in general. But that said, we're talking about, I had the blinders on.
Yeah.
I did always like have, you know, I liked some hip hop too, right? Mm-hmm. Like throughout all this. And I was paying attention to some rock music too. But just to be focused, you know, to get at a certain level though, you really did, I really was focused on the jazz. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And so when you came to Vancouver and you started doing the cover music thing and started to meet different musicians, that you said that was 2009.
Yeah.
So it's coming up on a decade since then. Like how have I know that we talked about you composing music as well. I guess the question would be like, at this stage in your life and your career, how do you sift through the different things you could do as a musician and apply, how do you decide what to do? You know?
Well,
there's different paths.
Again, we all have to work, right? And like if I'm going to be making my living purely through music skills, which is what's happening now, right?
It's going to start with what's available.
You have kind of a list of tasks that you have to do.
And if all those are crossed off, you know, and sometimes that's easily done and sometimes not, but if they're all crossed off, what remains? Like, what are the things that you want to be doing with the time that's left over?
Oh, I mean, like, I'd like to play jazz, like, all the time, really. You know, like, ultimately, that's, you know, that's still my identity in my mind is, like, what I do, you know, in terms of what I have to offer, you know, like what I'm good at.
It's kind of interesting for us to have a conversation with jazz. I hadn't thought about this before we set out to do this interview today, but because for me, I can kind of maybe be the voice of many listeners who are aware of jazz as a thing, but I can't say that I have any, even though I'm a musician, like I have no experience, I think, of I don't know, diving into music on that level, you know? So for me, it's kind of like, I'm not going to pretend to really know anything about jazz. Like anything I could, if I had to explain jazz to somebody, it would just be any of the cliches or generalizations about jazz that any person knows by quickly going on Wikipedia or something, you know? So for me, it's, I mean, when you've spent so much time dedicated to it, can you explain more to me and to the listener who might not get it, why it means so much, what it is that you say that when you have that time left over, well, I'd want to be playing jazz, I want to be with my colleagues playing jazz. What is it? What is it about it?
Well, I feel the most liberated in that setting, for sure. Like, I feel like, well, this is how I can be the most expressive, right? When I'm playing Taking Care of Christmas, whatever, it's like, it's not, it's...
I'd love to hear you jazz that up, by the way.
Well, I mean...
That would be the ultimate challenge.
Maybe we should isolate my keyboard tracks from last night. You can hear a little.
Was there some of that?
I'm just trying to spread the Christmas joy. What were we talking about?
Well, I guess I'm just sort of acknowledging that for me, I can't interview about jazz music as if I know anything about it. I'm not going to sit here like this is a jazz show and we're going to talk jazz.
Right.
Like so many of our colleagues, as I mentioned, went to school for music for jazz.
Yeah.
You know, and so I guess every once in a while I witness a conversation or little snippets of conversation that occur amongst jazz nerdlingers who have lived in that, whether it's a little inside joke or a more lengthy, thoughtful conversation. And when I watch it, I basically am just like, I appreciate it. I appreciate the respect for music, the respect for jazz. I kind of have the impression when you talk about those blinders, like that period of time, I've been left with that impression that there's some of these guys, whether they continue to or did so for a period of time, like you mentioned, just that dedication and commitment to really thoughtfully engaging in something, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I find it interesting.
Well, it's high level because things go by really fast. And then that might be something, you know, part of the allure for me too, the challenge, right, of like being able to do it.
Intellectually, executing as well. And what is there also just sort of I wonder whether there's a comparison to improv comedy in the sense that you can have a scripted, if you're an actor, you can go out on stage and you've memorized all of your lines and you know exactly where you're going to stand and exactly what he's going to say and then I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can go out on stage and be like, what's going to happen? Is there an element of that when you're playing?
Well, I mean, it's not so much, it's not complete freeform. There, even though there is jazz music that is, you know, what you just
explained. That would be more extreme.
Yeah, that would be pretty far left there. But it would be more like, okay, we're going to talk about this or we're going to broach this subject and that's, you know, and then you
live in that area.
I'm off with my cliche sayings here. You let the cards lie, or is that what I'm trying to say?
Let the cards fall where they may.
Oh, wow.
But I don't know if it's the cards that fall. It might be the chips.
That's the chip.
And I don't know if it's, chips
hilarious.
From playing cards or is it potato chips? I don't
know.
But you're a poker player.
I know. That's so funny that like I'm like whiffing on like.
Well, maybe
saying.
It's because you're a poker player that you're whiffing because you've heard such trite cliches so many times.
Yeah, right.
That you're trying to get it out of your system somehow.
No
you know?
One to hold them, no one to fold them. Right.
There you go. Now you're starting to warm back into it there.
But you know, but there is a little bit of structure though. You know, there's like there are some boundaries and there are some you know, you operate within a field, right? Or within a box of like, okay, well, this is what we're playing with here.
Right. Right. And let's say if you're playing as a trio, or there's three musicians, and you, is it, how do you communicate with each other and understand when it's so-and-so's turn to kind of dance around this? Is it happening one by one, or is that happening simultaneously? These are maybe seeming like incredibly childlike questions for somebody who's, but for me, I don't know.
Well, if you're playing in a traditional piano trio, that's with piano, bass, and drums, the piano is like the main featured instrument because it's providing the harmonies and the melodies and
right.
and the rhythm too. And the bass is accompanying, you know, the bottom end, and the drums are accompanying the rhythm also. Yep. But the piano is like the main focus. I'm talking traditional piano trio.
Yeah. Right?
And then the pianist plays, usually states the melody, and then plays a solo through the form of what the song is that they're playing.
Yeah.
This is all very basic, you know. This is like you said, like a child. Yeah. If I'm explaining this to a 9-year-old, you know.
Depending on the listener, because actually, yeah, as you're saying, I'm thinking, well, actually, that's assuming that somebody knows what a form is, you know. It's hard to know.
But basically, you know, you do your thing within the given form, and then, like, you know, you state the end of your solo. And then maybe the bass player will take a solo. But basically there's an order of things. And I'm not saying an order of like there's a piano solo, then there's a bass solo, then there's a drum solo. I'm just saying like there's a form that we're all following. You know? And there's a map, structure.
There's a roadmap.
Exactly. There's a structure and there are rules, quote unquote, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
Meaning that like you're usually going to end your solo at the end of the form, right?
Yeah.
And then... so there's a logic that goes with it.
And so when you're playing, what are the best moments? What are the things that occur that cause you to kind of smile to yourself or smile to each other?
Usually when it's an interaction with the drummer or the bass player, if I do something and they catch on to it and then we're kind of doing, you know, then we've like kind of met, you know, in this weird... environment of like, you know, stuff is happening here and stuff is happening there. Sometimes we intersect and then we're like kind of together, but it's still in this kind of open kind of thing. And then, and you know, only like kind of sophisticated listeners might be able to pick up on that kind of thing.
It's kind of cool to think about humans agreeing on something and then meeting at a certain, in a moment without the use of words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oftentimes here we are communicating and using words, trying to understand each other or learn from each other. And maybe that's one of the beautiful things about any form of expression, in this case music, where you can kind of arrive at a place together.
Yeah.
And it wasn't agreed upon verbally.
Uh-huh.
It happened through music as a language.
It is. And it's just still this magical mystery tour thing, you know, like there are things that still can't be explained, but like we kind of know what is happening at the same time.
Yeah.
You know? When you get to a certain level and a level of understanding with the people that you play with, and that takes years.
Yeah.
Takes years.
Yeah. Every once in a while, I see some of those knowing looks exchanged on stage in the band that we play with together. And I kind of think, okay, that's cool. That's cool. I don't know what just happened. I'm sure something very cool. I clocked something last night that happened on the guitar. And as soon as I heard it, I instantly looked to our band leader to see whether he had that smile on his face, and he did, and I was like, that's pretty cool.
Okay.
Do you still do that weekly jazz? Was it a weekly jazz gig downtown?
I still do it, yeah.
Yeah.
Saturday, well, this is...
should plug that for somebody who's curious about
all
this.
I play in a group, which is the James Dandifer Trio, every Saturday at Uva Wine Bar, which is on Smythe and Seymour. It's kitty corner from the Orpheum.
Right.
And we play 9 to 12, and we've been doing that gig for 3 years.
9 a.m. to noon?
No.
Okay.
No.
For some reason, I thought it was like a brunch thing. 9 p.m. to midnight. Okay.
No, this is a evening.
That makes
this
a lot more sense.
Yeah, this is drinking time.
Right? Okay, right.
Yeah, fancy cocktails.
Not cereal, not drinking cereal. Drinking.
But
drinks.
I do that gig whenever I'm available to do it. You know, I play with Inside One too, so I did that last night instead.
Yeah.
But I'll be there the next couple weeks. Oh, no, I won't be there next week. I'll be with you this coming Saturday.
Right.
But we're also playing New Year's there.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. But I'll be there the Saturday after that, and then I guess the two Saturdays after that, and then New Year's.
And is there different guys subbing in and out?
Well, typically it's the same guys.
It is.
Typically, it's the same drummer. And
you're
the
one subbing out.
Yeah. Well, they sub out too sometimes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But it's still a regular gig. You know, it's still a nice gig. And, like, we have a lot of fun. And, like, we have regular people who show up every time. And, yeah.
When did that start? When did you first start doing that?
3 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
I guess one of the challenges for me to go, for example, is because it's on a Saturday night. It's like that's right. All of your musician friends or performer friends are never able to go.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well,
maybe I just concocted this fantasy. It was at 9 a.m. to render it more possible. There's some reason why in my mind
that's impossible, man.
I envisioned it being during the day, and maybe it was just hopeful thinking.
Jazz is a nighttime music, Jeff.
That makes sense. I could tell by the look on your face. Like, 9 a.m.? Come on. There must be alcohol. There must be darkness.
Yeah, totally.
And possibly heroin. What is? I keep thinking about heroin when I think about jazz. Can you explain to me why I have that misguided?
You know, it is misguided. I mean, the guys are the pioneers of jazz music namely in the 40s, 50s, 60s. Maybe it died down a little bit in the 60s. I'm not an expert on the heroin usage, but a lot of the icons went through this phase where they were doing that a lot.
Okay, so it's associated with certain iconic figures.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, well, I think one of the most notable ones was Charlie Parker, and, like, a saying was kind of circulating, like, if you want to play like Bird, you got to do like Bird.
Right. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what it is when you talk about being in, having the blinders on, you know, it kind of, for me, conjures up the idea of an obsession, mm-hmm. and... You know, and there's a good thing to mastering something or pursuing mastery, but also it's a choice in life to care about something so deeply, mm-hmm. to go so deep. And maybe that's what I'm thinking. I'm just thinking, wow, I wonder what those trenches are like for certain individuals. You know, maybe some people can get in and get out and it was healthy, but for other people, I wonder, you know, what that's like to make that sacrifice.
I think there had been some talk about how, like, it's perfect for playing jazz because it puts you in a certain spot of focus and you're able to, but I think it's just kind of a bunch of BS though.
Yeah.
You know,
it's probably like, best to err on the side of believing it's BS rather than, like, you know, rather than assuming you need to get a tourniquet. And,
you know, I mean, like, I think there's a bunch of careers that were really just destroyed by all this, you know?
Yeah. I guess we're just talking about drugs generally,
you know?
Just the people's perception of drugs generally and what it does for you.
Right.
Because I remember thinking that with the Beatles, for example, that's a really well-worn cliche with the Beatles. Like, mm-hmm. whoa, man, the stuff they did was crazy. They must have been so high.
Yeah, right.
And it kind of gives the impression that in order to create interesting things, it starts with being really high. But with the Beatles, I can promise you didn't start with being high.
Right.
It started with being creative and having whatever, especially between John Lennon and Paul McCartney, whatever they had and whatever they developed over years.
Mm-hmm.
There might have been an experience of being high and maybe or maybe not that played a role, but it's so beside the point.
Yeah, I
so
know. I understand it's kind of like you can't
I mean, the way
credit,
you're reacting to this line of questioning, or I mean, bringing that up as a concept is exactly how I would feel if people were like, the Beatles, right? They wrote great songs because they were always high. Is that correct? I'd be like, oh, okay, this old chestnut. Here we go.
Yeah, I know. That's just kind of, that's the easy kind of solution, or it's not even a solution. Yeah, lazy. Yeah, it's
lazy.
Just kind of like, oh,
yeah.
But nah, it starts like lots of hard work. You need talent. You need talent.
Dedication.
You know? You need talent, dedication, persistence.
Yeah.
And yeah, you need a lot of luck too, though. You need a lot of luck if you want to get into a situation where you actually get to kind of be doing this, you know, and to hook up with the right people. And to be on the right path.
To create music that's widely heard by people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But just to play it, like, just to think that a substance actually is a shortcut to, like, playing great or something like that, it's just kind of silly.
It's different, I can tell you from personal experience, when it comes to hosting college radio shows.
Yeah.
Because there was a long period of time where I would do this show sober, thinking that was professional or something.
Uh-huh.
And the show was...
You're not sober right now? What?
No. It was okay. And the reason, if you're wondering why this show is... I mean, now you're inside of it. You've heard it before. People listening know. This show is amazing, in my mind at least, because I took a little bit of everything earlier today. Every drug you've ever heard of, I just took a little bit, created this concoction. And
all right.
And that's the way to do college radio.
Okay.
No. That's probably not true.
Yeah, now we're talking about jazz.
Exactly. Let's talk about composing music. Okay. I'm interested to talk about that. You know,
sure.
We're talking about playing music and genres, but regardless of you being a player and regardless of jazz, just the idea of composing music, I guess, is interesting to me because, I don't know, because I have my experience of creating music and I have my experience of executing cover music. And I mean, it makes sense to me that it's worth a shot because there's the experience of expression. You know, you take all these, you're taking all these things in. Why not try to spew something back out? But, you know, every musician I know has had their own experience of approaching this and trying this or abandoning it or whatever. But I guess the question is, what's the history of you having the audacity to compose music? I use that word not because I say it kind of tongue in cheek, but it is kind of audacious in a way to choose to try to create something, because it's so much easier to just say, I'll leave that to the people who have created what I enjoy, and I dare not try to express myself in this way.
Well, the beauty of being able to compose or of being a composer is that, well, it's your rules, right? It's your show. Like, nobody can actually say that you're doing anything wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Just freedom.
Like, well, whatever, man. This is my thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's always going to ring true, you know, for any kind of composition. It's like, well, no.
Did you always feel that way?
Yeah.
Like, from the outset, was that part of the appeal?
Yeah. I mean, well, I don't know. I really loved music, and I had these things in my head that I wanted to get out. And then, like, when I played them, it was like, well, this is mine, and nobody's going to, you know, like maybe it might sound wrong to somebody else, but it sounds good to me. That's all that really matters, you know?
What was the beginning of you composing music? I mean, I imagine when you first learned to play piano, there's going to be some version of you come up with.
Not so much. Not with the piano. Like, that was when I joined, like, the rock band and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like when I was trying to just write some rock songs. And then when I was playing piano or studying jazz, I was studying the material, but like, well, I really loved Thelonious Monk, right? Thelonious Monk.
I'm aware of the name.
Yes.
The name, because it's
he
such
was
a cool
quite,
name.
I really enjoyed his compositions, and I was influenced by his compositions, but I liked this idea that he had this identity as like this unique composer too.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be a unique composer also, right? So I was influenced by his aura, and I composed tunes that maybe kind of sounded like his, but like, you know, with sprinklings of other things, you know.
Yeah.
But basically, the whole idea for me was that it's like, well, I mean, like, once you do this and once you put your name on it, it's like it's yours.
Yeah.
You know.
It's yeah.
Like nobody's gonna. There will be again people who might not like it. There might be people who really love it, you know, and then there might, but whatever, it doesn't matter though, because once you've given birth to something, it's there and nobody can take that away from you.
It makes sense to me. And I imagine there's a lot of people out there who can see the appeal of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But when they sit down to do the thing, whatever it is, I'm going to write a novel, I'm going to write a screenplay, I'm going to paint something really great or whatever, and then they realize there's a lot of hitting your head against the wall.
Yeah. Well,
where they abort. Yeah. So for you, did you have early on or throughout up to the present, do you have those experiences or does it flow pretty easily for you?
Well, there's plenty of bad music that I've written, you know? Plenty, but like for every 10 bad things, there could be one good thing and like maybe one great thing too, you know.
Right.
But like you just had to, it's basically like, I don't know. I mean, like if in baseball, you know, if you're successful 30% of the time,
yeah,
then you're successful.
And you're in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, there's that whole 70% there where you're failing, right?
Yeah, right.
So
you have to be willing
to
fail.
Kinda, yeah, and you have to do a lot,
yeah,
basically. And you have to, like, give yourself the opportunity to succeed or fail. You have to give yourself many opportunities for it to go either way.
Did you realize this early on and you've abided by it ever since? Or did you have to arrive at this?
I think maybe my first couple things that I wrote just for myself, I thought were good. And like, I only wanted to write good songs. But then after a while, it's like, well, no, you just kind of write stuff. And like, sometimes it clicks, and most of the time it doesn't. Most of the time, right? I mean, like, I'd like to think I'm, like, really prolific, but, like, you know, like, yeah, I think you got to write some bad songs, you know? like there's got to be a discard pile, you know?
Of course. Yeah, I guess I'm intrigued by this topic for my own sake, mm-hmm. and also from talking to other people. And I do kind of just feel like it's kind of, I don't know, I think I've observed it's often the case that people are very quick to say that they are not creative. Like, they either, it's very binary, either they are or they are not. Like, mm-hmm. I can't sing, I'm not creative, I'm not this, I'm not that. You know, like, for me, the equivalent would be like dancing or something. Like, the truth is I can dance, mm-hmm. but it's about how comfortable I am with it. If I'm not comfortable, then I might decide that I can't do it to relieve myself of trying. And going through the possibility of embarrassing myself or failing or whatever. And I see this so much where people typically just say, I am not this. And but I think it's kind of a natural state of affairs as a human being to have creativity. I think creativity is actually probably just part of being a human being. And maybe other people might be more built for it than others for whatever reason. But I think it's part of being a human being. But I notice for most people, and for me, there's most of the time for me, I don't know. I resist it. I resist sitting down and doing it because I guess I just find it so painful to deal with that discard pile, you know? And it's kind of embarrassing for me to know that or say that because I'm so aware of all this conceptually. Mm-hmm. I can sit here and hear what you're saying and I know it to be true. It's annoying for me to know that and for that to think about being dominant, like ruled by that, or that to affect my experience of living. I find it embarrassing. So I'm interested, you know, in your case, when you say you know this and you've managed to hang in there and create some things that you're happy with by dealing with the stuff you're not happy with.
Well, you need reps, you know.
Reps.
You need reps. You need to
gym. We're talking gym talk.
Yeah,
now.
Basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sets. It all
reps.
Comes back to sports for me. You know, I'm a musician, but like, you know, you can. We could do a sports podcast.
Sports analogies.
Too, I'm sure.
Oh yeah.
But you need reps though, because you need to get good. It's a skill, right? Like composing is a skill.
Yeah.
Again, sometimes
a
you
muscle.
Come up with a good. It is muscle, and you need to work that out. And again, this goes
I'm
back
so flabby.
To the whole like, yeah, it goes back to the whole baseball thing where it's like, well, you know, if you're 3 out of 10,
yeah,
songs that you write are good, like you're doing great.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. You know, when I look at my experience of being creative over the years, it's like, I think that my batting average is, like, how do I say this without sounding immodest? I think I have a really high batting average, mm-hmm. which sounds immodest, but actually I don't think it's a complimentary thing to say to myself. I think if it's true that I've had a high batting average, all that matters mm-hmm. is that I've been too afraid to go play ball.
Mm-hmm.
For fear that what, you know, that it's, I'm going to lose it or something. I don't know. But that's my opinion about myself is it's like you've shown legitimacy to this and yet you're not willing to step up to the plate. What the hell?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of fear of, you know, well, there's fear of failure, but there's also fear of failure in front of people or like, you know, a fear of judgment, right? Fear of like what other people are going to think, basically. And like you really, I think the muscle that you need to work out is the whole not caring about that.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like, well, first of all, you're never going to please everybody. You know,
yes.
like that much we all know by now. It's like, you know, like not everybody loves, you know, this
mm-hmm.
or whatever. But you have to like really... I think that's how you get stronger, especially in music and especially in jazz. I tell this to a lot of my students. It's like, well, you got to go do this and sound bad in front of people. And then that's when you start getting stronger. You know, you have to have these moments of clarity where it's like, oh, I don't have this together or whatever, you know, and you have to be thrown into the fire. And, you know, that's how you build the character, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's, you know, it's amazing to have this conversation. I just know these things so well. It's the power of whatever it is. I don't know, for me, if it's a fear of judgment from an audience. I think it's more just frustration with stepping out on stage. For example, a few years ago, I did stand-up comedy, mm-hmm. almost as an exercise.
Yeah,
I think there was a part of me that had become very infatuated with the art form,
uh-huh.
and there's certain figures that I just thought, wow, like what a great uh-huh. thing to do if it's done well,
uh-huh.
to be able to express interesting, important ideas mm-hmm. in a way that's, there's no better way to get somebody's ear and have them be open to some of your ideas than through laughter.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing comes close to that. Here we are on campus, and there's a lot of esteemed intellectuals, I'm sure, who talk to the room, and people are bored senseless because it's humorless. You know, if you put that esteemed professor next to Bill Hicks, comes to mind, as who for me mm-hmm. is like a comedy hero. It's the ideas are going to be better absorbed mm-hmm. when Bill Hicks expresses them, because laughter just kind of opens everything up. So when I realized that, I didn't necessarily think that I was capable of that. But when I realized that, I thought that is a good thing to do with a limited experience of consciousness. If you're going to be around for just a limited amount of time, that's a good thing to do. Be aware of what's going on, have opinions about it, express them, and do it in a humorous way.
Yeah.
And so for me, that kind of guided me to try. Basically, I wanted to try it as an exercise, though, and a fear exercise, because people, I mean, most people are terrified of public speaking.
Of course.
Period.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm talking about speaking in front of people. No obligation to make them laugh.
Right.
So if you add to the element an expectation you're going to please people with humor, there is nothing more vulnerable that
you
can be asked to do than to walk on a stage with a microphone. Here he is. Apparently, he's a hilarious guy.
Yeah, right.
Victor Noriega. He's going to fill the next 5 minutes of your life with hilarity. And then you step out there and you think, oh my. So for me, that was a specific exercise I did where I did maybe like 50 sets.
Oh, yeah.
And I promise you that the vast, not that it's hard to believe, that the vast majority of the time that I spent up there was not being hilarious.
Right.
And so for me, that was an exercise in, can I survive this? Can I go out there and if I'm not making people laugh uproariously, I'm not talking about tittering, but if people aren't laughing like, oh, I'm so surprised by what was said and that's great, you know, it's making me so happy right now, then I'm failing. And that's what I almost exclusively was doing, with some exceptions to the rule. And for me, that was an exercise in being willing to stand in front of people and just failing.
It is character building.
It is. And I think I'm okay.
Thick skin. You need thick skin.
I think I was okay with that. I mean, as much as anybody can be. Mm-hmm. You'd rather please people than disappoint people. But I proved through doing that I could survive it. But the missing part for me was, you know, beginning to maybe craft some jokes, and it started to work a little bit. But just, I don't know, just feeling like I'm not coming close to hitting the mark. And I think that's, for me, when it comes to songwriting, in this case, stand-up comedy, maybe doing this podcast, anything that I try, where it gets to that point where it's just like, you do, speaking for myself, do it in a functional way. And I can take some pride in the fact that I'm doing it at all, but not really taking any pride in doing it well, you know? And I guess that's where the patience comes in, you know?
Right.
So for me, I don't think it's so much the fear of judgment or failing others. It's more like a fear of failing myself or something.
Well, I can...
This is turning into therapy on Now We're Talking. By the way, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Victor is here to conduct some sort of therapy for me as, I'm not going to say a failed creative, you know, force, but definitely somebody who struggles with the thought that I am, you know.
You have not failed at all.
As long as I'm still alive.
You're still here.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're expressing ourselves right now. Right?
But can we agree that if, when we leave the studio, I am killed, tragically, and I hope that doesn't happen, but let's say that it does.
Okay.
Then I was a failure because I never managed to resolve these things. It was always in flux. It never got resolved. Absurd. What an absurd notion.
I was going to say, like, okay, when it comes to, you know, playing jazz, this it's all about sports and playing jazz with me, right?
It is.
But, like,
I can attest to that.
I can say, and I don't know if everybody will say this, but, like, it's only, like, a couple times a year where you really nail it, you know? Like, really nail it. Like, where everything, you know, where you do exactly what it is
you
set out to do,
it.
And you feel like you nailed it. That's only that. Those are rare times.
But you have
for
to
the most
show up.
Part. But you show up, and then like you do a decent, you know, like you want to do a good job all the time, right?
Yeah.
But like, and you know, like I make plenty of mistakes when I play in the jazz setting, right? But again, maybe a couple times a year, it's like, oh, okay, I really killed it. You know, I really nailed it. But, you know, for the other times, it's like, yeah, well, I did pretty good. And it goes back to the batting average thing. You know, it's like, I want to play good phrases all the time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to go 10 for 10.
But if you have that expectation, you'll drive yourself nuts.
Mm-hmm. But the thing is, you got to, but, you know, not every phrase that you're going to play is going to be what you were planning on it being, you know?
Yeah, as you say that, it makes me think, and how presumptuous it would be to imagine you already know what perfection is, because how are new things meant to happen without the willingness mm-hmm. for unexpected things to
right.
occur?
Right, well, you got to take some risks. I guess that's, I'm saying, you know, a couple times a year, you take the risks and, like, it pays off big time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? But for the most part, it's like there's a lot of failing going on. You know?
And in terms of your, back to the composing, the experience, yeah. some of the work that you've composed, and I alluded to this Oakland, this thing
oh,
in
yes.
Oakland. Like, have there been moments in terms of your compositions where that's occurred, whether it's when it's being played or when you're writing it, just, is it the same principle that every once in a while you're like, ah, this piece of music feels good, it's resonating, it's hitting the sweet spot,
yeah.
I'm proud of it, I'm happy with it.
Yeah, well, I guess we should maybe back up and let's talk about this, what this Oakland thing actually
please
is.
Do.
Yeah.
Please do.
I got this opportunity, and this is where I was talking about you get opportunities, you get luck. I was very fortunate to be given this opportunity to compose a symphony for the Oakland Symphony Orchestra. This was in 2012, and they gave me, like, basically a year to come up with this composition, right? And I'm very fortunate to get this. And I had put out a record previous to this, which kind of put me on the map to Oakland. I did this jazz CD, jazz record of some Filipino folk songs and okay. like some original compositions kind of inspired by these folk songs also. So they had me come write this piece for, it was basically Notes from the Philippines, which was the name of the show. They mm-hmm. had another Filipino composer, Filipino-American composer, same opportunity, right? Like, we're going to do a show, we're going to feature you guys as these Filipino-American composers. And it's a very cool thing by Oakland to do, really.
Yeah.
It's the East Bay Symphony Orchestra.
Okay.
Oakland, man, I'm drawing a blank, man, I'm failing, you know, there's all kinds of failing going on here.
There you go, that's yeah. the same thing.
Yeah, same
here,
thing.
Here we are, willing to have this conversation, we've got yeah. to accept those moments too.
But, so this is what we're talking about, the Oakland thing. So I
yes.
wrote this piece, and it's 20 minutes long, and I had never written for orchestra before.
Wow, I mean, I can't even imagine,
it.
I can't
you know,
even
I was able, you know, I write compositions on the piano for myself and for my own group, but like, there's like...
You have to arrange everything for
yeah,
every
yeah.
part?
Yeah, and
how big? How many players?
Like a full orchestra, like 76.
Oh my God! Yeah. 20 minutes of, just to break this down again for the layperson who might not be a musician. We're talking about 20 minutes of music that's occurring,
yeah.
And there's 70 plus instruments, and you're
yeah,
arranging.
They
all
don't
of this.
All play at the same time for 20 minutes.
But you're creating
right.
things for them to
yeah,
do.
Yes.
Over this 20-minute period
so
of time.
So that
crazy.
Said, we were talking earlier about like things that work and things that don't work. You know, like. Or feeling satisfaction.
Yes.
I feel satisfaction for completing the project.
Yes.
And like I've been able to get the piece performed a couple more times also. And
okay.
like I would still like it to get performed here in Vancouver eventually too, because I think it'd be good. Within the piece, you know, I haven't heard it in a long time and perhaps there'd be some moments that I'd like to tweak. There are moments that I feel are like, yeah, that's, you know, I did what I wanted to do there. And then, you know, also when you're writing this, like you have it in your head and you also have it in the computer. And then when you hear the playback on the computer,
simulating
it's not
going
to be, yeah, it's not what it's actually going to sound like, right?
Yep.
You hear that in the rehearsal and then maybe you adjust some things too, right? This goes into the whole, you know, batting average thing. It's
yeah.
like, you know, but I think I did pretty well. I think I had a good average on this piece.
I assume that you witnessed the performance,
but
right?
I think, you know, if I were to get it performed again, I would review it, and then I would be like, okay, what can I change here again?
Was it like to create this and to plot it out on your computer and hear playback, like digital version of it, and then to sit there? Maybe you went to the rehearsals, or did you?
Yeah,
just...
I did. I went to the rehearsals.
So,
yeah.
What was it like to see, sort of have life breathed into it?
Well, it was incredible. It was really incredible because when you're hearing it on the computer, and you know, you just want to make sure all the notes are right.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. But like, it's way more beyond just like the right notes.
Dynamics.
The dynamics, the articulation, the expressiveness. Like, there's like. That's something that, like, the person who doesn't know much about music or the non-professional, they think it's like, oh, he played all the right notes. Great. Well, nah, that's like just the beginning, right? There's so much more to it. So when I'm listening to it on playback, it's really just to make sure all the notes are correct, you know? But then, like, a lot of work gets done in the rehearsal, you know, like, let's play this passage this way, you know, or let's back up and, like, you know, let's put a little more oomph into this phrase here.
Yeah.
But that all happens in a team situation or team, like the conductor helped out with this too, because I was not experienced with working with an orchestra and telling the orchestra what to do or like not having, again, I composed the piece, but then there were other, the conductor helped out with the, you know, making it sound as good as it could sound also. Yeah. It's a team thing, right?
Yeah. I wish I could have been there at that performance and just, I would have watched you watching it just to see the look on your face. Just the concept.
Oh, I played in it too, though.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I wrote myself into it, right?
Oh, smart.
And the thing is, well, yeah, because it was kind of a jazz piece in a way.
Okay.
You know?
Wow.
Yeah, I even like, you know, I had an improvised solo in it, you know, that I wrote from, you know, that I gave myself space to improvise, right?
And was it recorded that night?
It was. Wow. It's in the archives for the Oakland East Bay Symphony Orchestra, and I have a CD just for my own. This is nothing that I could release, but like, again, I want to get the performed.
Right.
I'd rather get the piece performed.
Yeah. Rather than
different
now
cities,
play it.
Rather than be like, hey, check, you know, click on this link and do this.
Well, that's good, because that makes me feel okay about not having in advance asked for that piece of music to now play on the show, because that would be less than telling people to wait to see it performed in Vancouver, possibly in 2018 or 2019. It's too soon to say.
Too soon to say. But that's the beauty of having the piece, you know? I mean, like, I gave birth to the... And that's another beauty of the whole composition thing. It's like you're giving birth to these, you're planting seeds, and then they grow into something, and like you can come back to it later. You can, some just get put on a shelf to die, I guess. But like again, the bad ideas, you know, the discard pile.
Right. But this is not.
But nonetheless, but even in that discard pile, if you come back to the things in the discard pile, and then you can kind of morph them into something else.
Sure. Or maybe you discarded it at a certain a point in time because it seemed like it was to be discarded, and later you see it differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I say discard pile too, I'm not talking like, I'm just talking like ideas for a song or some whole songs are in the discard pile. But for the most part, you just want like an idea or a motif, and then you put them all into the pot, and then like you create, you know, you mix and match and you put things that might fit together, and then, you know, it's a creative process.
Yeah. Right?
But there are some ideas that, you know, were lame ideas 10 years ago that like I'd love to check out now, you know, then see if there's something that I could do with it.
Yeah, especially because you've changed in that period of time.
Yeah, I know. You're going to be a little bit more rock and a little more cover.
Yeah, totally. Like, you know, oh, wow. There's a lot of top 40 influence here.
Like, really accessible to the, you know, to the radio.
To the wedding, crowd.
Yeah, exactly.
We've just got a couple minutes left, but I want to acknowledge that your wife's here with your small child.
Here.
And one of the cool things I love about you guys is that you're both achieved musicians, both achieved piano players.
She is high-level musician.
Yeah.
She's at, you know what, I'll say this on the radio. She is great. I'm like borderline great pretty damn good.
It's official. I'm pretty damn your good, wife but she's is better
always
than you.
Great. Yeah, she's always great.
That's a smart thing to say about your wife. I have to say, you're good at this whole marriage thing already. And I guess bring it back to, I'm thinking about your dad and how he was a piano player, and I was talking about how interesting it is for a kid to be around music. What's it going to be like for your kid to have two, to have this DNA and experience
well,
of having two parents that play so
well? Our daughter has, when she was in the womb, my wife played a couple concerts and, you know,
that's
and
amazing.
So like the baby was there soaking this
wow.
stuff in, and it's like, you know, it's like an actual concert situation.
Right.
The baby was there.
Wow.
So, but that said, it's not like we're hammering, you know, that's not like we're.
That's not the plan. You're not grooming for her.
No, if she was some hedge fund operator eventually, I'd be happy with that too, you know.
Take but care like, of you.
Yeah, but she's getting exposed to music.
And yeah,
she's
and just
getting
the DNA.
Exposed to our yeah.
it's so intriguing.
It's in there, right?
Regardless of whether she became a player, just her connection to it. It's I find that so intriguing. You know, her opportunity to feel that connection to music. So I'll be keeping tabs to see what happens on that score. Thanks for coming in, man. We talked about you coming for a while.
I
appreciate it.
That went by like so fast.
Yeah, well, there's all sorts of things we could talk about.
I know.
I didn't really know.
I feel like we're just.
I didn't know what I was going to ask you about, but I was kind of appreciate kind of talking about creativity, and I just kind of tapped into that a bit and projected some of my own fears about it, because I really am intrigued to have people in my life who, and I know that it goes up and it goes down for everybody, but who have the courage basically to say, I want this and I'm willing to sit down and wait for something to happen. And so to think about that experience you had with that orchestra, I mean, to me, the symphony, that's something you earned by being willing to persist, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. Well, hey, I had a great time. Have me back, dude.
I will have you back.
Oh, just, you know, like I feel like we're just kind of getting this thing started.
This is just an introduction to the world of
Victor Noriega.
I feel
like it. I feel like there's all kinds of stuff that
I agree.
We need to touch on next time.
I agree. You will be back. Thanks for coming, man.
Thank you, Jeff.
Cheers.